At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey, this is Jen Johans at FilmIntuition.com or FilmIntuition on social media and Letterboxd, and this is Watch with Jen and Friends. If Watch with Jen is the studio track, this is the acoustic version. Today's guest is William Boyle, the critically acclaimed author of the novels Gravesend, The Lonely Witness, A Friend is a Gift You Give Yourself, and The New City of Margins, as well as a short story collection, Death Don't Have No Mercy. Boyle recently guest edited the 8th quarterly volume of By NWR, entitled Dark Brink of Love. It's described as a dispatch from the broken open world of noir and is now available on Nicholas Winding Refn's website that is linked to you in this post. Boyle's books have been nominated for the New Blood Dagger Award in the UK and the Hammett Prize in the United States. A Brooklyn, New York native, William currently lives in Oxford, Mississippi. He's a knowledgeable film lover with excellent taste and an avowed Tori Amos fan. I am so pleased to welcome him to Watch with Jen. Another thing about William is he's the perfect person to be talking to. When you get to the second question and realize you've forgotten to press record, he graciously agreed to let me go ahead and start over, so what you're about to hear is me being completely embarrassed and William just being his laid-back, cool self.
Okay, so I'm recording now.
Okay.
So that was just like take one.
Yeah, it's good. I wasn't doing that well anyway, so I get another shot.
Oh, no, you're fine. Okay, so I'm a disaster, but anyway, starting over.
Yeah.
So, William, how are you doing and how are you adapting to quarantine life?
I'm good, thanks. I've just been pretty much doing what I normally do, writing and reading and watching movies. And, some things have changed, obviously. Not going out, not going into town, not going to work. But for the most part, things are pretty much the same for us. I've been doing the things I like to spend my time doing. And I've been really worried about New York. I live in the South now, but all my family and all my wife's family are up in New York. And so we've been kind of, really just stressed out about that more than anything else and how bad it's been there. Aside from the kind of general panic and dread, it's been nice just kind of being around and doing work and enjoying watching films.
Good.
How about you?
Kind of the same thing. Attention spans are shorter, but definitely seeking solace in good movies, books, writing. And I wanted to say congratulations on the new book. I know you were supposed to come to my local indie bookstore here in Scottsdale, Poison Pen. I ordered it from there. It's here, signed, on my shelf. I'm so excited. For those listening who may not be familiar with it, what can you tell us about City of Margins?
Thanks so much. It's set in my neighborhood in Brooklyn, kind of southern Brooklyn, Gravesend, Bensonhurst. That's where I grew up. And it is set between, it starts in 1991 with a prologue, and then the bulk of the action is set in 1993. And then the epilogue is 1994. So it's early 90s. I wanted to go back to the neighborhood as I knew it, kind of growing up. I was in high school. It's kind of the early 90s would have been, in 92, I think I started high school. In 96, I graduated high school. So it was really the time when I was kind of living there most intimately. And I haven't lived there full time since the early 2000s. So when I go back and when I write about it now and set books and stories there now, it's sometimes a challenge because I'm there in my mind in the 90s and the 80s. And even though my family's still there and I'm back there all the time, it's still kind of like my experience there ends sort of in this certain way in the early 2000s. But most of my books are set in this part of Brooklyn. So that's not really different. It's just that this is, I think the scope's kind of a little smaller in this one. I kind of kept it really tight on the neighborhood and just, well, that's a weird thing to say because actually the scope is kind of bigger in this one in a lot of ways. It's an ensemble thing and there's a bunch of different characters we follow, but the actual scope of the setting is smaller and it kind of stays in that part of southern Brooklyn and doesn't stray into the city or upstate like some of my other books do. So yeah, there's seven main characters and it's just kind of, I kind of been calling it a noir melodrama or crime melodrama, which is how I like to think about it. A lot of paths crossing and really influenced by film in a lot of ways. I mean, I love, Robert Altman and Alan Rudolph. And I think I wanted to write a book that felt like that sort of, so yeah.
Perfect. You actually fed right into a question I was going to ask you.
Cool.
While reading the excellent A Friend is a Gift You Give Yourself, which I loved.
Thank you.
So good. I was drawn to the way you write character point of view, especially its many strong female protagonists. They're all so specific and just so interesting. Your writing strikes me as very cinematic. And I was going to ask you if films had inspired your work, and it sounds like they have.
Thanks. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I think for me, film was kind of my first love. I loved books pretty early, but I think I got into the books that I love through film. As a kid, I didn't love reading what I was reading in school at all. And it wasn't until, I don't know really how I didn't have anybody guiding my hand as a kid with films. Nobody in my house or family or no friend that I think I can think of liked movies in that way, really. My stepdad a little bit, but even him, not really. So I just kind of started finding stuff on my own and watching a lot of movies. And I think by the time I was maybe 11 or 12, I was watching a lot of crime movies and really, you know, obviously like probably seeing some stuff a little before I should have. Seen it.
Same.
But yeah, you know, so I saw Goodfellas and Raging Bull and
yep.
And all that stuff and, you know, kind of changed everything for me. And then I saw Blue Velvet when I was 12 and that kind of changed my whole worldview, really. Mm-hmm. And then I started seeing, you know, anything I could see. I mean, I go to the video store just as much as I could. I was trying to see at least when I was a kid, 12, 13, at least 10 movies a week if I could. I had very, you know, lofty goals as a movie watcher, I think, as a kid and kind of still. And so I kind of naturally stumbled into, because of the timing, because I was growing up in the late 80s, early 90s, it was like this golden age of neo-noir stuff. So I just kind of saw, I saw The Grifters and I saw whatever came out, Miami Blues, you know, whatever came out like that. And that led me to reading Jim Thompson and Elmore Leonard and Charles Williford and all these writers who shaped my taste. And it, you know, and it continued. I mean, I think I never differentiated between, you know, loving movies and loving music and loving books. It was all kind of just me feeding this whatever, you know, and I didn't have anybody telling me that this is high art and this is or anything like that. I mean, I just loved what I loved. So I kind of went all over the place and followed things wherever they took me. And it was a really just a great way to learn. And so I think definitely, you know, my visions of New York City and of the time were shaped predominantly by film. You know, I mean, I grew up with Scorsese. So, you know, that's like the New York that, as much as, you know, listening to the Velvet Underground or the Ramones or something, it's like those are the movies that make the city for me.
Very cool. One thing I really do enjoy about your social media presence is just how passionate you are about not only books, but music and movies. And I always look forward to seeing which films you've been seeking out because they run the gamut. Like you said, there's no differentiating, and that's a good thing. You watch everything from Criterion Channel titles to cool forgotten movies you find on YouTube, and I'm always wondering how you find those. But have you made any good discoveries lately? Anything you'd want to recommend?
Yeah, let me think about that for a second. I never know. That's part of what I love about it. I love kind of just following a thread somewhere and seeing where it goes. And I'll go on these kind of random runs out of nowhere that I don't expect to. And that's always kind of what guides me and what I think I get really excited about. So last year, at the end of last year, I went on a Audie Murphy run, I've always kind of liked Westerns, but I'd somehow only seen one or two of his films along the way. And I think I watched 26 or 27 in a 2 month period. And so that was one of my great discoveries of last year. There's something about him that really drew me in as a presence. And a lot of my movie time at the end of 2019 was dedicated to finding stuff by him, and some of it was pretty available and some of it was a little harder to dig up. Lately I've been, this year so far, I think the kind of three major things, I went on a little bit of an Edgar G. Ulmer kick. Detour was a movie that absolutely changed my life. It was one of those movies I saw when I was in that age range of 12-13. It was just randomly on, I think, PBS one night, and I saw it and I loved it. I don't know if I knew why I loved it at that time, but I loved it. And I realized recently that I hadn't actually seen a ton of his movies. I'd only seen Detour and The Black Cat, I think, maybe one other one. So I started off the year by just kind of dedicating myself to trying to watch some Edgar G. Ulmer movies. I think I watched 9. So that was fun. And there are a couple of really great surprises in there. This movie, Saint Benny the Dip, which I loved, which is kind of a crime comedy thing in the early 50s. It's definitely on YouTube. And I think it's also on Prime. It's not a very good print. It's like public domain, crappy print. But that was a good one. And his this melodrama he made in the 40s called Her Sister's Secret. I love that. Okay. Then I discovered a thing that blew me away recently was this writer-director who I'd never heard of named Erin Dignam, D-I-G-N-A-M. Okay. And she made two movies in the 90s that she wrote and directed. The first one is called Denial, and the second one is called Loved. Sorry. They both star Robin Wright and the first one also is, who else is in it? Jason Patrick and Ray Don Chong. And then In Loved is Robin Wright, William Hurt, Sean Penn, a couple other people. And I was like just blown away that I'd never even heard of these films. This is kind of my favorite kind of discovery, I think. And they were both great. They both kind of blew me away. Denial, I liked a lot. And then Loved, I thought, was just kind of a masterpiece. And then, her credits get kind of weird and she disappears for a while. And then she's got some screenwriting credits in the late 2000s and the 2010s. And they're prominent movies, but they're movies that didn't do anything. The first one is called The Yellow Handkerchief. So I watched that too. I can't remember the director's name, but it also stars William Hurt. Kristen Stewart. Right? Eddie Redmayne. And it's based on a Pete Hamill. This is actually how I found her. Was that I was looking up Pete Hamill's screenwriting credits for some reason, and I saw that he was credited with a story on this movie, The Yellow Handkerchief, and then I found her and I watched that movie, and then I went back and watched the other ones. Yellow Handkerchief's okay, it's pretty good, but those 90s movies were the ones that were really, the thing for the 90s, obviously. It was my time, and I think I love finding stuff from that time that I kind of even though I was paying so much attention at that time, I think if I spaced on something, it just kind of, or if I missed something, it just kind of disappeared for all these years. A couple of other movies from that time that I've watched recently that I had no idea about were OK Garage with Lily Taylor and John Turturro. And it was a movie that I could not imagine that I'd missed given the cast, just those two alone. And actually, Jed, our mutual friend Jed, let me know about this movie. I think it's on Prime. It's under a different title. Looks like a bad racing movie. It's called All Revved Up or something like that. but the movie's actually just like a quiet New York City character thing from the late 90s, which is, you know, just right up my alley. So that was another good one. I found this movie from the early 90s called Handgun that I'd never heard of, which also had an amazing cast. It was the only movie written and directed by this guy, Whitney Rancic. And you can watch it on Vimeo for free. And it was just like another one of those movies where Treat Williams, Seymour Cassell, like a bunch of people from The Sopranos, before The Sopranos. And it's just this, you know, New York City crime comedy thing from maybe 94, 95, that kind of blew me away. So those have been some of my bigger discoveries. But I like keeping track of kind of my favorite first time viewings of, so I do that as much as I can.
Are you on Letterboxd?
I am, yeah.
Okay.
I just started that because I like those Pure Cinema guys, and they do.
Oh, Brian,
he does a lot of like favorite first time viewings, and so that kind of inspired me to keep track of that stuff a little bit more. I mean, I think I was always logging the movies that I watched on Letterboxd, but I was never making specific lists like, oh, these are the movies I watched this year for the first time that are older films that I've never seen that just blew me away. So that's been fun to keep track of that stuff.
I need to get more ambitious with my lists there. I'm always logging things and then looking back, because actually Brian was the one that inspired me to do it.
Right.
I would write for his site like a couple times a year.
Yeah.
You know, best discoveries or that kind of thing. And
that's
then
right,
have to remember, what did I watch? So it was a good way to start keeping track of that.
Yeah, it's really, and I also like, I like the list function just because sometimes, like when City of Margins came out, I thought, I was talking about films that inspired it, and I thought I should have just been keeping track as I wrote the book of every film I thought of, or every, you know, everything. And so I kind of went back and did that and assembled the list for City of Margins as like 50 films that in some way, even if it's only really minor way, inspired something in the book or that I was thinking about. Now the new thing I'm working on, I'm doing it as I do it. So I don't have to go back and dig through my notes or my memories to kind of try to figure out what it was. But yeah, I really enjoy it. It's a fun thing and definitely a nice way of kind of keeping track of stuff, because some stuff I remember and some stuff just kind of flits away very quickly. And I like being able to look back and think about what I've been watching and why. And you know, there's a story there, I think, you know.
Yeah, it is interesting. It sounds like you're finding a lot of good ones streaming. But are you still a collector of physical media, or have you started to like cut back on that?
I am. No, I love physical media. I watch a lot of stuff streaming because I don't know. I mean, I think it helps me watch more ultimately. You know, I think I can watch stuff while I'm out or at the, you know, I haven't been doing it during quarantine, but I go to the gym just so I can watch movies on my phone, basically, you know. And, you know, so I'll watch a lot of stuff on my phone, especially if it's like, I know that's not a great thing to admit, but I will do it. And especially if it's like a crappy YouTube print or something, I don't really feel too bad about watching it on my phone. But I love,
That's I smart. Love physical. It would make me exercise more, I think, if I did it while I was watching movies. That's what's missing from like physical therapy, and that's keep people motivated, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it. That's all I need.
I love that idea. Sorry.
No, it's great. I mean, it really does. It does motivate me ultimately. Like, I mean, I do a half-ass job when I go to the gym, like, but I'm more excited about getting to watch a movie, like having an hour and a half where I could just kind of go on a bike or treadmill or whatever and just watch a movie. But yeah, physical media has always been really important to me. I think I kind of don't feel like I don't like not to have a physical version of something that I love. So I think definitely love, you know, I love all forms of anything, music, you know, records, CDs, cassettes. I love all that stuff. I do listen a lot on streaming, but, you know, obviously books, I love physical stuff. I don't really read a lot on Kindle, but I think, more than ever, I've been kind of collecting Blu-rays lately. So, I just like it. I mean, I've always loved, having that, you know, having a kind of library of stuff around. So, I mean, there's something exciting about it, especially when it's something that's like kind of, you can't find streaming and you can only get a physical copy. So I think I'm always kind of thinking about that, and I like supporting any of those kind of great, labels that are putting out this stuff, you know, from Criterion to Arrow to Kino Lorber, or, you know, whoever. So I like getting as many as I can. I mean, I can't go broke doing it, but I try to get at least a couple a month if I can.
Smart. Do you have enough shelf space? That is my eternal battle. I never have enough shelf space.
No.
So I have like bags of book or of DVDs.
Yeah.
It's...
No, I'm like that too. I'm just kind of I've always been a collector of books and records and tapes and movies, but I'm not like a good storer of those things. I'm not, I don't have great shelves. I just kind of pile things on my desks and tables, and I have I have bookcases, but I just have like, you know, milk crates full of Blu-rays and a couple of old cabinets. So I'm not great at doing that.
No. And everybody's like, oh, just keep them alphabetized. There's too many.
No, I like, there's something I like about every time I want to find something, it's like a massive search.
Yeah.
I mean, I like that. I like digging around in record stores. I like, you know, I like the idea that if I want to find this book, it's not exactly where I know it is. Like, I got to go do some work to remember where I last put it, or if it's hidden in a row behind a row on a bookshelf somewhere or whatever.
Yeah, then you find like six other things that you forgot about, or or you haven't watched or read or listened to in a long time. Well, one thing I was going to say too, additional congratulations on your collaboration with Nicholas Winding Refn.
Thanks.
The volume that you guest edited. How did you get involved with that, or with Refn?
It was kind of a strange process. So the managing editor of BionWR.com is this guy Jimmy McDonough, who is I think predominantly known as a music writer and film biographer. He wrote a big biography of Andy Milligan, that kind of underground director, called The Ghastly One. But I think most people probably know him because he wrote biographies of Neil Young and Al Green. So he's the managing editor of the site, and he is good friends with a friend of mine, Scott Beretta, who's a blues historian and radio show host here in Mississippi. And I think he just kind of called up Scott and said, hey, do you know anybody? They'd had somebody else lined up for it, and that person wound up not working out, and he called up Scott for some reason. He likes to read a lot of crime fiction. And Scott recommended me, and that was how I kind of wound up having a shot at it. And then it was kind of a process of pitching them on how I'd approach it. And they were really into just kind of doing it in kind of as unusual a way as possible. So that process lasted a little while, and I just kind of very quickly wrangled together a group of writers, and it was about a year, almost a year all told, from it getting started to it posting.
That's awesome. Lots of work.
Yeah, it was a ton of work. And, I didn't have anything to do with, I think some people think I selected the films. I didn't have anything to do with the selection of the films, which are great. It's the noir volume, and they kind of stretch the limits of what might be perceived as noir.
Gotcha.
I think, but I like that. I think that's really good. So there's this movie Stark Fear, which is kind of a low budget, just psycho kind of knockoff from the early 60s made by two University of Oklahoma professors. And then there's this movie One Shocking Moment, which is basically a nudie cutie by Ted V. Michaels. And then there's Guilty Bystander from 50, which is probably the most, or definitely the most traditional kind of noir film of the group. So they pick the films, they restore them, and then I curated the content surrounding the films. And I, for the first time, everything's free on the site. And for
Very
the first
cool.
time, I did a lot of, they'd never had anybody do fiction. So I did a lot of fiction kind of inspired by the films, or just kind of bouncing off of locations or feelings. So it was a fun, weird project.
I'll be sure to link to that in the post. And okay. I love that they're making those movies available, I saw.
Yeah.
Is it? Yeah. I've been noticing some of the by NWR ones popping up on Mubi.
Yeah, they do. I think they run them there first. So all three of these ran on Mubi before they went live on the site. So, yeah. And then they've been also, they did the restoration of Night Tide, which is amazing. With Dennis Hopper, the Curtis Harrington movie, and that's out from Arrow now, and it looks I really want to get it, but it's kind of, I haven't seen it available here, so it's been kind of one of those Arrow Blu-rays that's more available
England.
In the UK
yeah.
and not as much here, but it's so they've been linked up with some cool places.
Very cool. So speaking of movie, and we talked about Criterion, do you have a favorite streaming channel, or you just kind of pull from all of them?
Oh, man, yeah, I pull from a lot. I definitely love Criterion, probably most of all. But I also really love Canopy.
Yes.
I think Canopy's been really probably the place I go to the most in some ways. They have a lot. I mean, they have a lot of the Criterion stuff. They have a lot of, and a lot of the stuff that gets rotated out on the Criterion channel remains on Canopy, so that's cool.
Yeah.
They have a lot of Kino Lorber stuff. They have a lot of Cone Media stuff. So I find a lot of amazing stuff on Canopy, but it's always like I get it through the university library for free, and I'm always afraid it's just going to disappear one day. I'm not going to have access to it anymore. So I like that. I don't want to plug Amazon at all, but I do like Prime just because I feel like I find stuff, such random stuff there, and I could just dig around forever and find, I just find a lot of weird, good stuff on Prime, I think. Netflix. I mean, I have Netflix. I'm not always. It seems like they're adding more stuff. I just saw an article today that they're finally they're adding some kind of actual classic stuff, which is something they really lack heavily, I think.
Very much.
But I keep it just because The Irishman and stuff like that.
There's good stuff, but
And then I've been kind of exploring. Some of the free sites a little bit more, like Tubi and Vudu and Crackle. I mean, there's that's where I think it was Tubi where I found, I was looking for those movies by Aaron Dignam, and they were both on Tubi. So it was stuff
Good
I couldn't
know.
Find on YouTube or on Prime, I was finding on some of these sites, and that was really that was fun. So I've been kind of tapping into that as a resource a little bit more lately. But yeah, I mean, other than that, I think that's about everything that I have. I have, you know, like Turner Classic app that I use a lot, but I log into that through my mom. My mom's got a subscription, so I just like tap into her subscription so I can access that app. So, because I don't have cable, that's my way of seeing Turner Classic.
I know, and they were playing so much good stuff today too, like Laura to Have and Have Not. And
yeah,
it's just a knockout. Yeah,
yeah, they have some incredible. They go on some incredible runs where it's just like I gotta rewatch all of this stuff. And it's always exciting on Turner Classic when there's some movie that you really just can't see anywhere else.
No.
And it happens pretty frequently, I feel like. I mean, I love Turner Classic. I mean, anything really that will give me the fix, I'm good with. But
spark your imagination or send you on your creative runs. I love that. Yeah. I like when a movie inspires you to look for something else, and then it's just a whole chain of more films and it's a rabbit hole.
I was on one different thread. I don't even remember what now. And now I'm like in the middle of this Tony Scott kick, and I have no idea really how or why it started, but I'm just enjoying watching all of Tony Scott's movies, you know, and trying to track them down and going to different places and seeing what's available where. And that's part of the fun of it. And that's been actually, I should have talked about that when I talked about recent film discoveries, because just yesterday I watched his first movie, which I'd never seen. He made a short in the late 60s that's like an adaptation of an Ambrose Bierce short story. But then right after that, in 1970, he made an almost feature-length film. I think it's about 60 minutes, called Loving Memory. And it's amazing. It's like a Bresson movie or a Bergman movie. It's like, you know, you would not recognize Tony Scott's hand in this. And yet somehow it also informs kind of everything that he does. It's just about an old couple or an old brother and sister. You think they're a couple at first, but they wind up being brother and sister. That's not really a spoiler. They kill a cyclist on the road, and they bring him home, and the sister just kind of winds up pretending that he's their dead older brother. It's kind of silent for long stretches. It's really good. So that was kind of like, that was a movie I never would have watched probably if I hadn't been on this kind of Tony Scott completist kick.
I'm missing a few. Why I thought you were going for The Hungers, because I see it's on Criterion.
I did watch that. Yeah, it's Leaving This Month.
I had never seen it, and so I'm like in the middle of it. I have to finish that. I'm watching that right now, actually.
Yeah, I rewatched that a couple of days ago, and I watched. If you count those first two shorts, he's got 18 movies. I think I'm like nine or 10 in. And I'd seen, except for Loving Memory, I think I'd seen all of them previously. And the other short I haven't seen yet. But so most of them are rewatches, but I don't even know kind of why it started or where it started, but it started, and I'm kind of just really excited to be in the midst of it.
No, I love his movies. I've been wanting to rewatch Crimson Tide again.
Yeah, that's going to be one of my next ones. Yeah, that's always kind of sat in my mind at the top of his filmography. But I rewatching Deja Vu, I loved that. Yeah, I think that might be I think it might be his best, if not one of his top two or three. And also Unstoppable, I think, is pretty great.
That was underrated for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the one that I've never heard good things about it, and I hadn't seen it since it came out, but I rewatched The Fan, and I thought it was hilarious.
I thought it was good, actually.
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah. so I mean, over the top, but yeah.
It was very, I mean, it's like, you know, if you like De Palma and you like Raising Cain and Body, you know, stuff like that, then mm-hmm. you'd love, I mean, I would have to think you'd love The Fan. It's like just batshit crazy and kind of wonderful. Yeah.
It's over the top De Niro. So of course I saw it in the theater. I was like, opening day, dragged my brother.
Me too. And I don't think, I mean, I remember seeing it because I loved, and when I was in high school, I'm sure I loved Tony Scott because The Last Boy Scout and True Romance were huge for me as a kid. So I probably loved him too, but definitely De Niro. And I don't think I would have thought at the time, like, this is too much of the same, you know, after Cape Fear and King of Comedy. And I've seen people complain about that, but watching it this time, I was like, who cares? I mean, it's just so great.
Yeah, I think when people say that, it's like they haven't really explored his other movies.
Because
if you watch Mad Dog and Glory or Night in the City or other stuff, it's, there was more going on, but I think it's easy to throw him into a box.
Yeah, he's always been kind of all over the place and doing interesting stuff, I think.
Yeah, the other Tony Scott one that I just saw, I think it was last year for the first time, was Revenge. I had never seen it. That is an interesting movie.
It was great. I just rewatched that the other day. And I'd seen it, but probably not in 25 or 30 years or something. I mean, it came out, I think, 30 years ago. So, it kind of blew me away. I mean, I love Jim Harrison, and it's based on one of his novellas. So I was kind of expecting to be disappointed with it as an adaptation. And I wasn't. I thought it was, you know, this time. I mean, I don't know what I thought when I was 12 or 13 or whatever, but this time I was really pretty, pretty taken with it. It looked so good, and Anthony Quinn was great.
He really was.
Yeah, not a lot not to like in that movie, really.
Yeah, I don't know. Domino. That one never did much for me, except I love the style of it and the look of it.
Yeah, I just rewatched it yesterday, so it's fresh in my mind. And I actually remember Domino was, when it came out, I thought, I hate this movie. whenever it was, 2005, 2006, I hated it. I hated that style. But now that I've been in the middle of this kick, I think I watched it in a totally different way. And I'm just kind of...
Interesting.
And I also don't think, like, what I thought of as kind of hyper and frenetic in 2005 now is not really as much, you know, I mean, the way action is shot now is so much more kind of hyper and just all over the place. The Tony Scott movies don't look like that. They must have looked to me 20 years ago or 15 years ago. I liked Domino a lot this time, actually. I thought I laughed a lot. I think there's a purpose to kind of what he's doing with a lot of the way he shoots and edits those movies in the mid 2000s, that becomes clearer when you watch them all together. I don't know. That might be a little loftier than I should be thinking about it.
No, I can see that. Yeah. It's nice to look at the progression.
Yeah.
And I'm just glad you're another fan of Deja Vu, because you tell people that and they're like, really? You know, but yeah, I was
pretty blown away by it this time.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember liking that one when it came out, and Man on Fire too. But this time I was really like, holy shit, this might be one of the greats. I really like this movie. And Denzel Washington is just so, I mean, there's not a lot of actors of that level like him. You know, I mean, he's just so compelling. I watched The Taking of Pelham 123 remake that Tony Scott did, thinking, because I love the original.
Good. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, why, you know, I think that was the one movie of his I'd never watched, because I thought, one of the major films of his I'd never watched. And I kind of thought, why remake this movie? But I enjoyed it. And I mostly enjoyed it because of Denzel. I mean, he's just so good to watch. Like, I could literally watch him do anything, I think, you know, he's just great in it. He's amazing.
Yeah. I actually enjoyed it too. It was the one I saw first. And then I did a Cops and Robbers double or triple feature for my birthday. and did like the Seven Ups and the original Taking of Pelham. Yeah, and so I finally saw it, and of course, you know, that's towers over it. But
yeah.
I think, you know, you enjoy it for what it is, and it's pretty darn fun. Yeah.
And I think actually, and this is not, I saw some people, I was looking on Letterboxd and the reviews, and a lot of people were being tough on Travolta, and I don't think he's bad in it, but I do think if there had been like a De Niro in the Fan level performance in that part, it could have really worked a lot better.
Yeah.
I don't think Travolta was kind of over the top enough or something. I mean, he just kind of, it was kind of, I don't know, didn't
subdued.
Work.
Yeah,
it was a little too straight or something. But yeah, the other thing about Deja Vu that I thought, to get back to that one for a second, is just, I thought the chase scene in Deja Vu, just because you brought up the Seven Ups, and whenever I think of my favorite chase scenes, I think of 70s films, you know, Seven Ups and French Connection and Bullet, or, you know, which is 60s, but whatever. But I thought the chase scene in Deja Vu was, this time I was kind of like, this is one of the greatest chase scenes ever. I mean, it's, I'd never quite seen anything like that, I think. So that was cool to appreciate that.
And I dig the way he uses music in all of his movies, and using the Beach Boys.
Oh,
I thought
so
was
good.
So effective.
Yeah.
I don't even know how much that would have cost royalty wise, but I loved it. Yeah.
Oh, and the fan is all Rolling Stones and Nine Inch Nails. I mean, it's a weird combination.
Weird mix.
And Domino has got this, which I think made me appreciate Domino more this time. It's got this kind of collage feeling to it, just the way it looks, but also the way the music is cut. And there's like, you know, little wisps of Tom Waits songs that come in for like 30 seconds or 40 seconds. And so I even in that one, I thought there's a lot of music I don't really like in that movie, but he brings in these little moments of just kind of just great soundtrack moments.
Unexpected trippiness. Well, you're making me want to go ahead and rewatch Domino now, because I think the last time I saw it was 2005 for sure.
I watched it. It's on, where is it? It's on one of those. It's on one of those free services. It's either on, I think it's on Vudu.
Okay.
I mean, it's got ads, but you know, it's unedited and uncut. And so I watched it there.
Totally worth it. I enjoy scouring their library. They have some really good stuff.
Yeah, they do. And I mean, it's nice, like in the middle of a kick like this, like, because a lot of his stuff, I've been really surprised to see not much of his stuff is streaming anywhere. Mm-hmm. I think like Deja Vu and Unstoppable and Spy Game and one other one are on Cinemax. There's nothing on, the Hunger is on Criterion. I don't think there's anything anywhere else. And then like Vudu, I think, has Taking of Pelham 1, 2, 3 and Domino. But a lot of his stuff's not super, you know, it's only available to rent or, on, Blu-ray. I saw Revenge somewhere too. Or I think Revenge I tracked down on.
I found it used.
Yeah.
No,
it's on Crackle. Because with that one, I was going to buy the Blu-ray, but the Blu-ray is only the director's cut.
Oh,
and the original
cut. That's
the
one I saw.
Yeah,
so
the original
cut's
like.
I have to watch the original.
Yeah, I think it's 30 minutes long. It's like significantly longer, 30 or 40 minutes longer.
Oh, wow.
And so Crackle is the only place, apparently, that you can see the original cut. I don't know why, but
I'm going to have to watch it there. That's interesting, because I've only seen the director's cut, so.
Yeah, I guess it was one of those director's cuts where he went back and trim the hell out of it. I haven't seen the director's cut. I've only ever seen this original, but I think I'm interested in seeing the director's cut just to see what he did and why he did it. And, you know, but it's there.
So it's a good lesson to, you know, check your streaming, check all the apps, but also look around for those DVDs.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so you have to have a nice balance. I like that. That's
good. Exactly. Yeah, it's fun. It's fun to kind of get to play detective with some of this stuff sometimes. Yeah.
For sure. I think you're going to send me on a Tony Scott kick now. I like that.
I really didn't expect, I mean, like I said, I've always kind of liked him, but I think, you know, I can't remember what the motivating thing was for me. I think maybe I just saw Deja Vu was on and Cinemax, and I just went back and watched it, and that was kind of the first rewatch. But I think, you know, I do like Scout Tafoya has a couple of, he has an unloved video essay about Deja Vu, and I think he's got some other kind of video essay about Domino, and his kind of, I think I went back with his argument about those movies in mind, and it kind of made me see Tony Scott in a different way, and that was cool.
Cool. I'll have to look for those. Yeah. Well, I want to thank you so much for doing this and talking movies and books with me. I mean, this is like the perfect way to spend an afternoon, so I really appreciate
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. No, it's so great talking to you. I've been loving the podcast, and you know, thanks for having me, and happy to do it. I love it.
Okay. Well, thank you. I hope you have a good rest of your day.
Thank you. You too, Jen.
All right. Take care. Bye.
Bye.
This is Jen Johans at FilmIntuition.com or FilmIntuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen and Friends.